After his death in 1911, Gustav Mahler's music faded from concert halls until the 1950s, when European conductors and record companies brought it back and made it more popular than ever. What accounts for the early neglect of Mahler's music, and what accounts for its popularity today? We'll get some insights from one of Mahler's best-known works. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me is Kyle Knox, music director of the Wisconsin Youth Symphony Orchestras and associate conductor of the Madison Symphony Orchestra. Welcome to University of the Air.
Good to be here, Norman.
Mahler, who built these vast symphonies, at the same time was, it seemed to me, never too far from childhood. In fact, he talked about writing symphonies as being kind of like playing with building blocks.
Indeed. Yeah, that's a wonderful quote that really perfectly describes his process. And, you know, we'll sort of get into some examples, I imagine, as the hour proceeds, but of how he uses these small musical units and puts them together and rearranges them to make these giant musical worlds. But that building block idea is really, it's more about world building. It's these sort of coherent internal universes that every symphony represents.
In his time, he was best known not so much as a conductor, but as an opera conductor, in fact. But here he is writing all these vast symphonic works. Never wrote an opera?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. You know, of course, we remember Mahler as this larger-than-life romantic composer. This is the guy he was. This is why he's in our consciousness, you know, 100 years later. But in his day, he was really known as being a conductor. That's really what put him on the map. I mean, his compositions were events, and they were critics would show up, and they were spectacles. I mean, think of the Eighth Symphony, the Symphony of a Thousand. There's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people on stage. So, I mean, they were big public moments, and they drew attention. But in many ways, his music was ahead of its time, and so it took a few decades after his death for that to really for him to be acknowledged in the way he deserved to be. But it was really his work as an opera guy that really sort of brought him into public fame during his lifetime.
We're going to be looking at one of his works, which ostensibly is not an opera, but certainly is all about the voice and emotions, and it has a flow to it. And from the get-go, how would you describe Das Lied von der Erde?
Well, I think Das Lied is an interesting sort of portal into his creative process, and it answers this question that I've often been somewhat confused by, I guess, because I've spent a lot of time with Mahler's music and played a lot of it as a clarinetist and conducted a lot of it, which is that, well, you have to know a little something about his life first, which is that he spent basically 10 months out of the year in the opera house. I mean, he was an amazing conductor, amazing, first class, the greatest conductor in the world. And we have so many anecdotes and letters written by people in his orbit about this unmatched artistic standard that he maintained, and he had a fearsome demeanor, but he had this incredible charm and charisma and could just make people do things on the highest level. It wasn't just in the pit with the orchestra and the singers. He knew everything about dramaturgy, and he knew about costumes and lighting, and he was just the alpha at the Vienna Court Opera, truly, and he knew everything about stagecraft. Anyway, so he did that 10 months of the year, overseeing other productions, even the ones he wasn't conducting, premiering new works by Puccini. You know, he was there. And it was really only in these like 8 or 10 weeks during his summer vacations that he would compose his symphonies on his vacations. And so how is it a guy that spends so much of his life immersed in the world of opera, from the small houses all the way up to the biggest hall in Europe, never wrote an opera himself? I think Das Lied, which is a song symphony, which was really a genre that he essentially invented, is a very good example of like how he expressed himself, utilizing the voice and text and poetry, but integrating it into the symphonic form as opposed to on the opera stage.
What inspired him to write it, though, other than perhaps wanting to experiment in that form?
Well, the context of its composition was sort of a critical moment in his life. So he died in 1911, so spoiler, 1907 this piece was conceived, yeah? So just a few years before his death, but he was like in his 40s. He was like a very athletic guy, and there were really three major events that that were going to really impact the later years of his life here. The first of them was more of a practical thing. He'd been for years at the Vienna Court Opera. This had been his dream gig. It was the most prestigious job in his world. But I think he was tired of the political battles of maintaining high artistic standards and all of the frustrations that you can imagine that he endured there. There's also quite a bit of anti-Semitism in Europe at that time. And so all that's going on. And at the same time, the Metropolitan Opera in New York City is looking for a new music director in the new world. And so they approached him and they said, you know, we'll give you more money and we'll give you more free time to compose during your summer vacation, fewer responsibilities. And so he said yes. So that's the first major event. It's not such a tragedy, but it was a major disruption. We know that from letters of the time that, you know, moving to New York was difficult for him. The language was not his original language. The culture was completely different, of course. And he just loved European nature. He loved being in the mountains. And it's just very clear he was quite homesick. So we have that first major event, if you will. The second was much more impactful, and that was the death of his oldest daughter, Maria Anna, who died at 7 years old of scarlet fever. You know, one of the wonderful things about Mahler's life is because he wrote lots of letters and he had people in his orbit who wrote about him during his life and after. So like we hear, you know, the nanny, he's in his composing hut in the summertime off in the woods, and his oldest daughter would visit with him for 2 hours, you know, and she'd emerge covered in jelly. The nanny's frustrated. You know, I mean, they were very close. She was clearly, you know, his favorite kid. You know, it was very clear. And so her death really left a mark on him that he never really fully recovered from. In fact, his dying wish was to be buried next to her, and they are indeed buried together in Mahler's grave. You can find pictures of it online. Well, in the third event, this all happened right around the same time. Actually, it was the same week that the doctor came to their house to diagnose Maria Anna with scarlet fever, just checked him out and found that he had this congenital heart defect, which, although not immediately life-threatening, was going to lead to some complications. It was basically a death sentence. This is before the time of antibiotics. It would lead to an infection, which would kill people. And so on doctor's orders, he was told to stop exercising. And so for some people, you know, that you can take it for what it is. But for Mahler, I mean, he loved to swim. He loved to bicycle. And really, above else, he loved to hike in the mountains.
Well, even conducting is pretty demanding, wouldn't you say?
Indeed, yeah. I mean, sir, especially if the caricatures we have of his conducting, we don't have any videos, are any guide. Certainly, he was a very vigorous conductor. And really, it's that hiking piece of just being in the mountains, being on trails. He would stop and sketch out melodies and formal elements of symphonies literally in nature. That was a big part of his creative process. And so it was really within that context he had a sense that this next work was going to be his last.
Did symphonies for Mahler grow out of the songs, or was it the other way around?
Very much so. So as I was saying, you know, this idea of the song symphony was really his creation. You know, we had opera, of course, for a long tradition there, and we had symphonic form. But, like, the idea of integrating song into symphony was really something new. You know, actually, we can play a nice example for here that illustrates this. But the symphonies, of all 10 of them, half of them include some kind of a vocal element. He wrote 9 symphonies, and he wrote Das Lied von der Erde, which is itself a symphony. And so that's just present really from the very beginning of his symphonic writing. And this is a good example. This is actually the scherzo of his second symphony. Some of you may recognize it. So those of you who know the Second Symphony recognize that music. What you may not know is that that music is based nearly note for note on a song that he'd written a few years earlier called St. Anthony of Padua's Sermon to the Fish. And the song tells kind of a funny story about poor St. Anthony who finds his church pews empty. And so instead he goes down to the river's edge and sings to the fish. Literally, he calls each one out by name, the trout, the carp, etc. They all get his attention. But of course, they're not listening. They're just going about their life, and he's just talking to himself. And that movement from the symphony emerges from that song the way, you know, a flower would grow from a seed. Here's an example of that song.
Oh, nun just so predigt die Kirche friedlich. Geht zu den Flüssen und predigt den Fischen. Sie schlang mit den Schwänzen, im Sonnenschein glänzen, im Sonnenschein, Sonnenschein glänzen, sie glänzen, sie glänzen.
In fact, his first four symphonies, really, they're called the Wunderhorn symphonies because they all refer back to this song cycle, which that song is derived from, called Des Knaben Wunderhorn, which means the youth's magic horn. So, you know, to that earlier quote about world building, his symphonies are almost like super organisms. Those first four symphonies inhabit a world where these melodies, these musical ideas, make cameos between movements and even between symphonies, like they're inhabiting some larger universe that he's created.
Was Das Lied von der Erde, the Song of the Earth, a reaction to those three crises that you mentioned a minute ago?
It is. And it's really like sort of because he was facing his own mortality, I think, that he felt like he had to find a new way to connect to his creative process and to find really a new language. I mean, this is coming out of the Eighth Symphony, which is incredibly celebratory and glorious and eight vocal soloists and the whole thing and the big choir. And so the mood of this is just completely different. It's really him grappling with his end.
What did he use for, let's say, source material other than his own experience? Were there musical antecedents that were direct inspirations for Das Lied von der Erde?
Yeah, it's a good question. Well, a few years before this, someone had handed him this book of poetry, which he hadn't read until this moment. It was actually a book of 8th century Chinese poems, which had been translated by a guy named Hans Bethke into German. It's called The Chinese Flute. And so he was really interested in the aesthetic of Asian art forms. And of course, like Asian art forms were hugely influential in Europe at this point, in the other arts, certainly in sculpture and in costume design. And think of those like sort of flat aesthetic of painting and woodcuts, things like that. And Mahler certainly knew some Asian-derived music from having conducted Madama Butterfly, Puccini. And so he just thought this language might sort of communicate what it was that he wanted to say, I think, in this piece. And so pentatonicism, for those of you who don't know what pentatonicism is, penta meaning five notes, yeah? A lot of Asian music uses five-note scales. Dee-da-da-da-da, one, two, three, four, five.
Think of the black keys on the piano.
The black keys on the piano, exactly, or like wind chimes. Yeah, that's very different than the seven-note, say, classical Western music scale. The pentatonic scale has fewer dissonances. That's why they're used for wind chimes, because when the bars bump into each other at random, it avoids dissonances because the intervals are not very close together. So it creates this sort of open sound. And so the use of pentatonicism is a nod to the Chinese origins of the poetry, of course. But pentatonicism also has kind of a technical advantage because those five notes in the pentatonic scale include all the members of the major one chord and the relative minor. And so he uses this to great effect throughout Das Lied, actually.
What are the actual themes of these Chinese poems in the collection?
Well, the very first song, we could get into it, is called The Drinking Song of the Misery of the Earth.
That's kind of a contradiction in terms, at least in Western thinking.
Yeah, right. Indeed. This is my own personal theory, but the more time I spend with this piece, I kind of sense it. It's like the stages of grief. Yeah. And so the drinking song of the misery of the earth is really anger, I would say. And the character of this really comes through loud and clear. We'll hear a few examples in a moment. But you can hear this sort of pentatonic element right from the start. You'll hear actually in the horn and then the string melody, you hear those five notes or little fragments of them. There's actually a very important three-note melody, which you'll hear, which actually recurs throughout the piece and sort of ties the whole thing together.
Doctor!
Raging Against Mortality, as we could expect Gustav Mahler to do once he's gotten this diagnosis.
That's exactly right. And, you know, the violins play. Dee, da, da. That's like a little, it's the first three notes of the pentatonic scale. And that little three-note motive you'll hear, and I'll point it out in some later movements, recurs throughout the piece, really tying it together. But there is also something kind of ambiguous about hearing all five of those notes together, where it's sort of suspended. It's not exactly major. It's not exactly minor. It's this sort of blended, open, ambiguous thing. And that's really essential to the character of this piece. Yeah, like I said, anger rules here. He's raging against mortality and trying to make sense of it. There's actually quite a moment near the end of the song, which we'll play this in a moment, where spring is mentioned. And it's sort of like a brief reprieve from like the frustration and anger of the character of the rest of the song. And he sort of dreams aloud about the firmament and how it goes on forever. But then he immediately pivots and says, but what about us, mankind? We're lucky if we get 100 years to enjoy the rotten trash of this earth. Can you imagine a more vicious text? It's quite a moment.
He's world building.
He is certainly world building, yeah. And that it really starts us off on the journey, that first song, which is from anger to on this huge six movement arc that ultimately leads to acceptance and the incredible finale.
We'll look further at that journey, Das Lied von der Erde, the Song of the Earth by Mahler, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Kyle Knox. We're looking at Das Lied von der Erde as a kind of an entry point, in a way, to the work of its composer, Gustav Mahler. We can find that crises in Mahler's life did inspire him to write this work in 1907. One of the themes that you find in German vocal music and even in instrumental music through much of the 19th century, Einsamkeit. There's loneliness, you know, free but lonely, and various themes on that. And it looks as if this Chinese source also deals with that, and that's picked up by Mahler.
Absolutely. If you, you know, the text is very much in that spirit. In fact, even this next song, the second movement, which is called The Lonely One in Autumn, yeah, to your point. And our protagonist, if you will, unnamed, is sort of wandering, very world-weary, and, you know, the text says longing for sleep, but it really means longing for death, truly. Yeah, remember, we're still kind of early in these stages of grief. I actually think of this movement as depression, and the character of it is very clear. The opening is kind of cold and bleak. It's sort of like after the leaves have fallen, and autumn has that sort of gray, going on forever, like unchanging monotony.
A little seasonal defective order there.
It's like that. It really is. And in fact, so that's sort of the, there's an ostinato that sort of suggests that in the violins in the very beginning. And the very first solo you hear is the solo oboe a few measures in, and it's a version of that three-note melody.
Mm-hmm. It certainly has that autumnal quality. It reminds me of some of the things that Sibelius would be writing about that same time.
Yeah, I agree. That's right. It has that kind of atmosphere. Yeah, it's very moody. Yeah, and the whole song is like that. At one point, actually, near the end, we play another example for you. It's a great moment. Near the end of the song, it sort of aspires unsuccessfully to sort of break through the void. The sun is mentioned in the text, and it just sort of aspires to break the monotony. It's like a very juicy romantic moment, but it just crashes back to the earth unsuccessfully and sort of ends as it began. It's a great moment.
A ray of sunshine in that autumnal gloom, which I think is probably also a realistic description of the progress of grief, wouldn't you think, Kyle?
I think so. Yeah, it's like sort of not continuous upward trajectory, but, you know, up and down and up and down and up and down.
You mentioned that one of the crises that inspired Mahler to write Das Lied von der Erde was the death of his 7-year-old daughter. And I noticed there is regarding youth as one of the sections in this work. Do you think that's reflective of a child?
Could be, yeah. Yeah, well, the next movement is called Regarding Youth, and it really is about, to some extent, it's about not exactly childhood specifically, but about youth. It's very backward-looking. I mean, since Das Lied really is a symphony, even though it's not called a symphony for reasons that are, I can tell you a funny story about later, perhaps, but every symphony needs a scherzo, a sort of lighter dance-like movement, even a grim piece like this.
Third movement,
yeah,
typically.
Third movement makes sense, and I think he was kind of sensing that on the trajectory of this piece, people need a little palate cleanser. And so Regarding Youth is exactly that. And it has a very sort of airy, light texture. It's led by the woodwinds playing staccato. The low double bass barely plays at all. And the text is very charming, actually. It's the poem is called The Porcelain Pavilion, and it describes this scene, a green and white pavilion, imagine it, on a little island in the middle of a reflecting pool with an arched bridge going to it. And there's friends who are well-dressed, and they're playing and enjoying each other's company and writing poetry. It's just a very charming, very sort of Asian pentatonic sound to this movement.
Right, right in there with, Ravel and Debussy and the kind of thing they would be writing about that same time.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's right. It's really a product of its historical moment. But remember, this piece is written by a man who's facing his end, his mortality. And so this sort of cheery atmosphere is kind of a disguise. It's like a veneer. And the tell comes near the end of the song's middle section when the mood changes completely. He goes from major to minor, and the text draws our attention instead from the sort of cheery, lighthearted events on the island, instead to the reflection, the reflecting pool, the upside-down images of these people. And the music has, it's minor, but it has this like uncanny oddness to it. Like, something is wrong. It's as though like the spell is broken. I think of in the stages of Greece, this would be perhaps
kind of denial.
Denial, I think. Yeah, denial is the right one.
It seems to me, Kyle, there's a juxtaposition here that Mahler has used in the last couple of segments that we've been hearing from Das Lied von der Erde, and that is the light, the ephemeral, the beautiful, juxtaposed against this overarching theme of loss. And I'm reminded of John Keats' Ode to Melancholy. It says, "Melancholy, she dwells with beauty, beauty that must die."
Indeed.
Is that what Mahler is about here in these sections we're hearing?
I think that's it, exactly. It's the struggle with the impermanence of things. I think that's what it is.
And of course, Keats wasn't the only poet or composer dwelling in the world of beauty. And of course, the Chinese poet that, 8th century did you say?
That's right, yeah.
Was the inspiration for Das Lied von der Erde, was also concerned about beauty.
Yeah, it's sort of a timeless subject, I think. Yeah, that transcends the centuries and the cultures.
And I think we find that in the next section too, don't we, of the poem and of the Mahler.
We do, yeah. This next movement, the fourth movement, is kind of a funny shaped symphony. It's six movements. So this is the fourth movement here. It's called Regarding Beauty. And I kind of think of Mahler as being the original film score composer. His music has like an almost cinematic vividness sometimes. And so the text here describes some young girls who are sitting near the edge of a river and they're teasing each other and they're picking lotus flowers. You can really sense that. You can almost smell the perfume. The flutes are fluttering and the mood is sweet and playful.
Pflückten Blumen, zwischen Büschen und Blättern sitzen sie, sammeln Blüten, sammeln Blüten in den Schoß und rufen sich einander Neckereien
zu. Almost sounds like a folk song, the kind of thing Eric Kuntz would have recorded back in the day.
Has an incredible, I think Mahler had such a gift for this, of this, you know, I think he owes a big debt to Schubert, this kind of simplicity of melody, this very folk-like, you know, sort of song of the people style, despite the complexity of his music.
Did Mahler make any alterations when he used this translated text of the Chinese poet to suit his own world building?
He did, yeah. And, you know, and there's countless examples of this that you could write a doctoral thesis on, all of the changes. But I think this one is actually worth talking about. Well, what happens next as the girls are sitting there enjoying themselves is a group of boys pass by on horseback. And one of the boys' horse goes astray and sort of veers near the girls and tramples the lotus flowers before galloping away. And, you know, in the original Hans Bethke translation, it sort of just describes the scene in a matter-of-fact way. The steed of the one whinnies, shies, and dashes away and tramples the fallen blossoms. Just describes the scene, you know. Well, Mahler made these changes, and I think it tells us a little something about what he was trying to convey in his music. He says, "Over flowers and grasses the hooves are moving. They suddenly trample the fallen blossoms as in a storm. Its mane flies in a frenzy." Check out this line. "With nostrils hotly steaming." It has like a remarkable, like a almost graphic vividness, you know? And I think it's really meant to convey that uncontrolled awkwardness of adolescence. If you remember, I can just give you, before we play this incredible scene for you, if you remember from that segment we just played, the delicate flower theme played by the woodwinds. Bum, 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 ba-dum, bum, bum, ba. We'll play it for you. If you listen, that same melody, yeah, talk of world building using the blocks, is transformed into the galloping horses as the boys approach. This music has like a cinematic realism. It's sort of risk-taking. Listen to it played by the trombones a few moments later. He's the world builder. This is how he composes, just forever rearranging these parts to sort of advance the story. This is the whole scene, the girls sitting by the river and then being disturbed by the boys. It's like one of the most incredible moments in his entire output.
Wouldn't it be interesting to do a music video of Das Lied von der Erde? Mahler certainly gives us a lot of the clues, maybe all we need.
Indeed. I thought before we moved on to the next movement, it'd be wrong to not discuss the ending of this movement, which may be like among the best 2 minutes of music of the 20th century, perhaps. The horses have raced away, and the lotus flowers are sort of trampled, and there's always one girl. She's in love with the boy. And she sort of stares longingly after him. But the music really conveys this feeling about being young and in love and the sort of excitement and the awkwardness of that comes with youth and an experience. The music critic Theodore Adorno, who many people may know, had a very beautiful way of describing this ending. He said, "A section of music like this is granted to music only once every 100 years, and that it rediscovers time as irrecoverable." This music is debilitatingly melancholy and beautiful. It ruins the day for me. I can't do anything after listening to it.
We'll return to Mahler and Das Lied von der Erde right after this here on the News Network of WPR. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Kyle Knox, and we're looking at Das Lied von der Erde, the Song of the Earth by Gustav Mahler, which provides a lot of insights, not just into Mahler, but into music and even into the human condition. One of the human conditions touched upon in this work is drinking.
Right, well, he drinks to forget. He drinks to cope. And the first movement, the drinking song to Earth's misery, is an ode to drinking. And this next movement, the fifth, is called The Drunkard in Spring, is already completely wasted. And he describes that in a very clever musical way. But the first thing you hear in the beginning of this movement is a fanfare played by the horn. Yeah. And so it's just, what do fanfares normally represent? Celebration, commemorating some significant event. So, of course, Mahler's being sarcastic, yeah. But he uses the horn, as the horn was used in the beginning of the first movement. He's sort of connecting this sort of drinking theme between the movements. But it sounds like this. Uh, attentive listeners may have picked up that the horn, di, dun, 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 di, the first three notes are the three-note motif, di, ta, ta, yeah. And even more attentive listeners might have noticed the woodwinds played those grace notes, ya, ta, di, da, very quickly, da, da, da. Well, that's the three-note motif, but upside down. So they're sort of layered together. Yeah, so he's always mixing and matching. He's really trying to depict drunkenness in sort of musical terms. And so the way he does this is by changing keys constantly. You know, if you don't really have to know much about music theory to know this, that if you listen to tonal music, you have an expectation that you will end up on the one chord or some, you know, and the chords sort of follow in a sequence that eventually gets you home. You know it intuitively, even if you can't read music. And so Mahler sort of in this first minute of music, which we'll play for you, sort of makes a promise that, hey, we're in this key, and then sort of pulls the rug at the last moment. You end up completely in the wrong key. So our protagonist sort of stumbles and can't keep his footing, and Mahler can't stay in a key for more than 3 seconds.
Wenn nur ein Gramm das Leben ist, warum denn Mühe und Glück? Ich trinke bis
Yeah, so I think he's really drinking to cope and to forget. That's what's going on. And again, the whole movement is filled with brass writing, and it actually ends on the brightest major chord you could possibly imagine, but it's all just sort of for nothing. Yeah.
Very Germanic, though.
Yeah, very much so. So we're sort of nearing the end of the journey here. The final movement, Der Abschied, which means the farewell in English, is actually the stitching together of two different poets. One was writing to the other, actually, these 8th century Chinese poets. From the outset, which we'll hear in a moment, we hear the tam-tam, the gong, which is, of course, an instrument that's often the symbol of death. Actually, in the score, he wrote death knell next to this note. The form of Das Lied, 6 movements, is kind of lopsided because this final movement is as long as the previous 5 all combined. It's about 30 minutes long. And, you know, that the form of that, one could question, but it's very much by design because those 5 movements are really about earthly concerns, drinking and melancholy and these sort of day-to-day things. And really in the farewell where we're finally grappling with the true implications of all this stuff, those earlier movements are meant to sound sort of trivial by comparison. Of course, the seasons, as you may have picked up by now, are critical to Das Lied. The first spring is mentioned in the 5th movement. It's mentioned in the 1st movement. Autumn is, of course, the setting of the 2nd. The implied setting of those lotus blossoms and the porcelain pavilion is summer. But very clearly, based on the text, we're in winter here. It's sort of the beginning of the end. And the music proceeds with like an unnatural slowness. It's in this sort of encaged 4-4 time. It has this kind of plodding inevitability. It's a funeral march. Really.
A march, yeah.
It is, yeah. So, as I said, this movement is made up of 2 poems, and so each poem has its own section, and they both sort of start this way with sort of dark beginnings and then ascend into the light. before we play this next section, which is one of the brighter sections, I could tell you kind of a funny story. Well, the music here, this sort of 4-4 time signature goes away and it's replaced by 3-4, which is it's more waltzy, it's more dance-like. But I have to tell you, it's one of the hardest things I've ever conducted. Most of the musicians are sort of playing off the beat, and it's like all the elements of like rhythm and form seem to sort of fall apart. There's no one is playing with the beat, and people are playing complex polyrhythms, fours against threes and duples, and like there's so many things happening at the same time. It really gives it this kind of, it's very harmonious, but it's almost chaotic, like atoms are breaking apart. And there's a very funny thing to happen. So Mahler never heard this piece, but he sent the score when it was done to his former assistant conductor, who himself became a great conductor, Bruno Walter, who actually gave the premiere a couple of years after Mahler's death. And he wrote in a letter, so, you know, here, check out this thing, et cetera. And by the way, that one passage in the sixth movement, think of this, Mahler, the greatest conductor in the world, writing to his student, he says, "Do you have any idea how to conduct that passage?" Yeah, and so these sort of brighter sections both sort of go this way. And really, like, now we're finally getting to acceptance, you know, his final sort of being at peace with the sort of never-ending cycle of the world. And I think that's really what the meaning of the title is, the Song of the Earth, and the use of the seasons as a theme here is, of course, they create sort of a natural contrast to one another musically from movement to movement. But more than that, the seasons are in an ever-present cycle. So actually, in the text here, he mentions spring one last time near the end. But instead of being mad at spring, he sort of celebrates that it goes on endlessly forever into the future. And as that happened, that final word, evig, is repeated like 7 or 8 times, quieter and quieter, as the piece sort of comes to this incredible ending and sort of just drifts and falls asleep with a very similar kind of beautiful, incredible texture that you just heard. We actually hear that 3-note motive one more time in the woodwinds near the end. But yeah, it brings this piece to an unbelievable conclusion. I would end with this. One of my other favorite composers, Benjamin Britten, loved this piece, and he had a great quote about it. He said about this conclusion that it goes on forever, even if it's never performed again, the final chord is printed on the atmosphere.
Das Lied von der Erde, the Song of the Earth, a great entryway into the world building of Gustav Mahler.
Indeed, yeah. A great piece. Can't recommend it highly enough if you don't know it.
Kyle Knox, it's been a pleasure.
Good to see you, Norman.
I'm Norman Gilliland, our engineer, Jeff Robbins, and you've been listening to University of the Air here on the News Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.